I just texted Tom. I
haven't responded yet.
Okay, so we don't have a quorum, so we just meet without a quorum.
Yeah.
So we can't even roll, is that it?
Yeah, quorum is only really important for votes.
So let's just go around and make sure everybody knows who everybody is and what your current role versus old role. So I'm Paul Harkin, I'm a member of the committee planning council.
Yes, I'm Mike Disapola, I'm a member of the committee. I'm also senior director of behavioral health here at the ACE Foundation. So I manage our outpatient and our syringe access services. So these intersections of homelessness and other things we'll be talking about really important to us.
Yay! Hey,
thanks.
Jason Albertson, ride along with Sharpton Sachta and a new hire at City Clinic for GTC, and formerly of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing Encampment Resolution Team. That's a mouthful.
Melina Clark, Council Staff.
David Jordan, Council Staff.
Mark Lamar, Council Staff. Okay.
Bill Bloom, DPH, Council Member.
Welcome, Bill. So, going to approve the minutes.
Can we approve the minutes?
Can we approve the minutes now?
Yep.
Did anybody get a copy?
I didn't make copies, but they were sent out.
Yes.
Oh, they're right there. Anyone need a copy?
Okay, sure. Sure.
Do you need
something?
Yeah,
be
good. I'll come on over.
Heck, we have an extra.
For some reason.
So much.
We just vote by consensus to approve minutes. Anybody object to the minutes? Okay, so by consensus, minutes are approved. Announcements?
Not really an announcement. I'm wondering, Melina, can you read the roster for the work group for the co-chairs and Bill? Who is considered a member?
Sure. So on the roster, I have Bill Bloom, Mike Cipolla, Dean Goodwin, Paul Harkin, Thomas Noble, Darvin Sachdev, Charles Cerrone, and John Paul Soto.
I don't know if people received the email from Cesar. I'm not sure how wide that went out, but he's had to pull himself in the loop.
He will be joining us at the commission, right now.
Announcements?
Do you want to announce about the lobbying effort that's happening?
Oh, that's on the first ring. So,
are we just discussing that nobody was here?
Nobody.
Well, there's five class members, right?
What was the initial?
I mean, part of the issue, though, is I think Irma couldn't make the stream, right? So
right.
She's not going to be able to participate. And then I think Margo wasn't sure.
Margo said she was not coming back.
So it really is in Charles's.
Out sick. Yeah.
But continuing.
Yes, Charles is continuing.
Okay.
That leaves just JP as the mystery.
Okay.
So quick announcement is speak out for overdose prevention services opportunity at City Hall. There's going to be a hearing on April the 11th, which is Thursday, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. And it's going to be room 263.
We can send an email to the group.
It's a special hearing on
working to support AB 362, which is to allow safe consumption sites. And San Francisco supervisors are basically passing something to support that, and they're looking for people to get down there and speak out on safe consumption sites.
And they are expecting opposition at that meeting. I'm not. I don't know if they've heard from some people, but they're expecting a pretty organized opposition. But I mean, at this point, we haven't had very much opposition at any of the meetings, so it'd be interesting to see.
Do you expect any opposition to be from neighborhood groups?
Probably the hate NIMBY, the renowned and famous cycle NIMBY.
I don't know, Andy didn't say from who, but he told me that they were expecting opposition.
Okay.
So, are we referencing the Business Association? Is that what you were thinking? I couldn't quite hear what you were saying there.
No, there's a person from the hate who's
a person
from NIMBY who
comes to everything that NIMBY opportunity.
It's
yeah.
A single
person.
Yeah.
No, the Chamber of Commerce supported safe consumption sites by 73%.
So we're on our way, you know. It's just, it's still the fear of the feds is what's holding things up.
Mm-hmm. So anybody else getting any announcements? Anything fabulous happening?
Jason just got a new job for Optin, so that we should announce that, which is like really a program that's directly addressing some of these issues. It's looking to follow up more robustly with clients who are on HIV meds and homeless drug users. So there's going to be a very kind of harm reduction collaboration around trying to get people virally suppressed and get people cured for Hep C, including mobile units, etc. So it's kind of exciting. This is brand new. Getting ready to roll. Okay.
Public comment?
Not seeing a public comment. So, pass.
So, group goals and tasks.
Here's a short list that we can still add to, I believe, right, Mark?
So we had our little preliminary meeting, and we were trying to keep it real on the one level, because we could get
very grandiose around policy changes and wanting to turn the city into Portugal, but that's probably going to happen right away. So
we're going for more practical solutions. So things like the release hours from jails and hospitals, I'm sure you've experienced this, Jason, you know, like,
they're letting people out at crazy times, when they're, you know, even when we have navigators who are working with that person and want them to come out at a reasonable time, they'll let them out at 1 a.m. or something. They'll just let a woman overdose immediately after she came out. You know, people have got caught up in
their old ways because they didn't have any support. So, I mean, that feels like
a realistic thing that the council could advocate, is like sensible release times so that people are not self-fulfilled.
There is a complicated beast around that.
Right.
And one of them is that legally the jail cannot keep you in jail for a minute past your determinate sentence.
Okay.
So obviously nobody's sentence ends at 1 a.m.
Right.
But they run a number of processes for your release and for everybody's release. So, Paulie, let's say you're in jail, and Mike, you're also in jail, and both of you are scheduled to be released at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. And they start processing Paulie, and they find out he's got a hot warrant out of L.A. that nobody knew about. And they're going to have to spend a lot of time on Paulie fixing him. So your release is going to get held because it's necessary, but the first moment they can spit you out, they will. So this is one of the institutional challenges with managing jail release, is do you ask people to stay a minute later in jail, which you can do, though it takes a judge to approve it, or do you spit them out on the street with, and this is the optional part, the support that they need to be managed into the next day. There's some stuff going on with Ali Riker's shop to do that, including having people available to pick people up in an overnight hotel room. Some of that is rolling now through the Office of Community Programs, but more than that little piece, I do not know. But it's always going to be this crazy challenge of, you know, you have a treatment bed for somebody starting at 8 a.m. the next day, and the sheriffs jump the gun and let them out at 1 a.m., because really their sentence expired the day before.
Right.
So it's a complicated beast to affirmatively manage, for sure.
However, it's caused death and all kinds of other shit, so it's worth taking a position on that and seeing if there's a way of creating sensible release policies that still satisfy the bureaucratic needs of law enforcement.
In the end, hospitals here, you guess, is that been a problem with the general hospital or county, the
general,
whole private hospital? It has been a problem in general.
Is it mainly the ER?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not like
also people sort of self-releasing themselves.
Yeah, AMA.
Because they're like, you know,
they're
dope sick and they're giving them like the Ibuprofen or something. Like, kind of cut it.
So
you know?
I'm just trying to think here, is there a desired outcome our group would want in terms of a policy change in terms of the hospital?
I think so, yeah.
Which would be?
Would be that, you know, when people who are got substance use disorders come in, it's like they're not asked to go cold turkey or get them like a fucking Valium when they're opioid dependent and we have, you know, access to.
But I'm just trying, and this is not a critique, I was trying to understand, because you have your expanded release hours. So this is just the first I'm hearing that it's a challenge in the Zuckerberg, in the general hospital, maybe it is in other places. So just to be. Cause
yeah, people get released again, like, say somebody's in for. Some other episode, but they've got Hep C and they've got Hep C Navigator, and we want to relink them to care or to be HIV, you know.
Right.
And what'll happen is we're like, yeah, we can come and get them, and then they don't release them till, you know, 11 PM or something, you know. And so then there's nobody there, and they've got substance use disorder, so while they're waiting for their next appointment the next day, one thing leads to another, they get a little distracted, and then they're you know, self-medicating.
Yeah, I get that. So I'm just wondering what policy change we, if we're thinking about.
I think
this,
some kind of coordination.
Some kind of coordination.
With the programs, and just understand that there's a whole class of people that are substance users that need slightly different. You know, one size does not fit all, and we need to more creative, compassionate ways of discharging folks from the hospital.
And they started this inpatient addiction service that has its own navigator. And I'm sure, have you met that navigator? Have your navigators met that navigator?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, yeah. But that's only one person, and not everyone gets the services
right.
The inpatient addiction team right now.
But
that model,
to make you up.
Yeah, that model could, improve the situation,
right.
As long as that navigator knows all the other navigators, and then it's able to
right.
Advocate.
So even like, you know, having some, maybe through our opt-in, we can kind of have that convening in a meeting that helps have services available for those situations. Okay.
So another thing we were looking at, I do believe opt-in does have some funding, was increasing training, so workforce development for people who work in, you know, places
like clinics where,
you know, the caregiver might be this very culturally competent caregiver, but the three people that you encounter on your way to that caregiver
have a big attitude around substance use and, you know, are stigmatizing you for your substance use. And so, you know, you've seen it with security guards, people won't even go to, like, say, like Tom Waddell or something, even though they really like Kelly Egan or another awesome provider, because they're getting disrespected as they try and enter. And, like, how do we know?
We send our navigators with people
to try and mitigate that. For Hep C treatment and for HIV, but you know, that's, we're a small agency versus the preponderance of this problem in a lot of different clinics.
Including, yeah, we see that
sometimes at Glade as well, when people come in harm reduction and they encounter the staff downstairs and they have, you know, a lot of issues around substance users and wanting to demean people and call them names, and then people don't want to come to the fifth floor to see us because they feel pissed, you know. So, you know, this is a, you know, we've seen this in a lot of play in a lot of different, and we hear it a lot. There was a human rights investigation in San Francisco General that, you know, they were guilty of immense abuse of substance users.
So, you know, this is a stigmatizing
thing that's been happening that we can definitely advocate for, you know, proper training for staff.
If your site is serving drug users,
then your staff needs to have a certain competence.
I mean, so
it just makes sense.
We're already doing this.
These trainings?
This was a recommendation coming out of these assessments 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Around mental health.
Right.
But of course, when we're talking about mental health, we're essentially talking about all severe
right.
need. And Kevin and I have been working, I think he's hired a consultant to start piloting a program to, specifically we decided to focus on security staff.
Right.
And it sounds like the intention is to roll it out at Warrior 6 initially, or just at general. Although there was a little bit of a funding snafu around that from HRSA, but maybe we, I don't know. But yeah, so
what's happening?
The ball is rolling.
Well, that's a part of it. That's just it's a private and the institutional release on the site. Sounds like you guys are going larger,
like
all the providers.
Yeah, I mean, our recommendation was also larger, but the feeling was that we couldn't
compel people, private security, to
take part in this necessarily.
Well, and the problem is that there's constant turnover of employees or staff.
Right.
So are there any modules that every staff member could take before they...
Yeah. I mean, part of it... One of the conversations around that was maybe developing trainings that we could then give to them as best practices.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure those security companies have some best practices around working with challenging people, but their mandate is different than service providers' mandate. So how do we find a middle ground, and how do we address their need to sort of for order and safety and
right.
while still being humane?
Yes.
And so one of the things we knocked around, Kevin and I talked about this when discussing stuff with the consultant, was potentially after this sort of initial piloting, taking some lessons learned from that and maybe developing something into a best practice or training module that we could just give to them for people who have contracts at service sites that are
right.
funded by. It's all,
mm-hmm.
I think it's
so
all...
So like kind of like when you're onboarded, you do this training before you even get dispatched to... I mean, certainly the safety net clinics are places where that would be an obvious place.
Yeah, again, I'm trying to understand if it's the security or the whole range of employees.
Could be security for front desk reception.
I think it's point of access.
First point of access. Okay.
Yeah.
So there is, to my knowledge, there's not a substance specific for the DPH clinic. What
right.
there is harm reduction
right.
and trauma informed care.
Right.
Everybody has to take, and then all the other ones. But there is a, so this group could conceivably say, we would like on the substance
yeah.
providing services for substance users to be something specific.
Right, exactly. Is the initiative that Kevin Hutchcraft is working on, is that solely for security staff, or does that include reception as well?
No, it's specific to security staff. Without
sheriff.
The brief thing, no, both sheriff, it's actually cadets, not sheriff. It's actually the sheriffs actually get a whole lot of training, so cadets get very little. So the focus is on the cadets and on private security.
Yeah. I mean, at least some of the conversation maybe earlier on that I had was that this would ideally be a test bed for some of those ideas that we could expand into something more more standardized around this. But
who's the consultant?
I don't remember off the top of my head. Do you? Either of you remember?
We've used her for trainings in the past around de-escalation, and she's blanking on her name, Natalie Thornson. She's from the East Bay, and her whole larger part of her CV and her background, social justice issues, and doing trainings around how to help protect people's rights and identities, and very affirming and positive. And she does really well with really large groups, and we've just had really good feedback on her in the last few years that we've used her.
Okay.
If this project's solely around security, maybe this group can weigh in more also on reception staff. That's
yeah.
a big part of the challenge.
Well. Now, they get a lot of training. There's a lot of stuff down in service recovery work, saying yes to your client. That doesn't mean it's successful, but
right.
they get a fair amount of training. Again, it's not specific to the skill set as well as the mindset of folks
right.
that are actively using substances.
Right.
So but they get a lot of training.
And turnover, though, is such a major...
For the front office? Because you've seen that in the hospital.
I mean, I've seen that, like, at City Clinic, I would say
so
that.
It's
a different
part of DPH.
But
the primary care clinic's not so much.
Oh, that's good.
It doesn't mean, again, I'm not saying, and I realize you're giving a general thing, and I'm wanting to go specific so we have something that's actionable.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm asking these questions.
Yeah,
so there's a fair amount of training for front office staff, not the specific
substitution. And, you know, like, Octane does have some as they're calling it, workforce development, and they're going to use the harm reduction coalition. They've got really good trainers for staff that are, it's not just, like, tolerating, it's, like, being much more affirming of people's...
040.
Yeah, it's more affirming of, you know, people's, you know, their ability to use substances. You don't deny them services because they use it. You know, you're looking at harm reduction framework for their whole care, you know, not like asking people to piss in cups all the time and judging them solely based on the color or the substance of their urine, whether it's, you know, toxic or not. Cool.
Do you think that those trainings could be directed toward reception?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely.
All right. And then Allison Decker, who's also part of Project Upton, is working on like a clinical provider pearls and has been getting input from Barry.
I am glad you're back down.
What?
I was supposed to get back down.
Yeah. So.
It'll go in your evaluation.
Right, so as she has reached out, just feel free to, like, we're hoping that the timeline on that could be completion by this month, and then, you know, review by as many people as possible before we get there.
I mean, we've definitely seen this play out in these clinics. We get our clients often talk about, you know, they went for their Hep C treatment, and, you know, they got disrespected before they got past the front door. So
if you're kind of ambivalent
already, these are things that you're like, you know what, I'm done. You know, you never mind you fell out stuff, you know, judgy, about the way you're dressed or your demeanor, and you are actually fucking high, and this is not an enjoyable experience, and you're trying to do a positive thing, and then you're just dissuaded, and you're off, and you're doing something else. And it's like, these are missed opportunities, and they multiply. And that's why you get cascades, you know, like, we don't do a good job of, and a city that does well with a lot of populations, where we can still improve the way that we work with people who are actively using substances. And we've seen great success in things like NTEP-CSF, you know, that's really focused on drug users and had very cultural competent approaches to working with drug users, and had navigators sit with people in appointments to make sure that they didn't get dissed or defended them when they did get dissed, and had, like, providers have to have little phone calls and say, hey, you know, when you were saying that wasn't actually correct, can I send you policy for treating people who are actively using drugs are actually a priority population. Perhaps you didn't read that memo. Should I get another doctor to talk to you? Because it's always easier to hear from another doctor. And lo and behold, suddenly they're treating that person. So that's what we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about changing systems that are, you know, stigmatizing and excluding people. I mean, it's fucking unacceptable. Simply. And we know that it works. I mean, the places that do it well, that have
Toronto. Oh, I think you went places in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Who do you think does it well in San Francisco?
You know, there's mixed bags. I mean, I think Tom Waddell's done a lot of really good work, you know.
I think health rates got better since Dr. Andy Tisrusso got fired. It's like between shift and that one. I mean, these guys do good work with the Stonewall.
I mean, I think there is a culture of indifference, and that's the entering threshold, which says you're here for care, it's a privilege.
Right.
And it kind of, the communication of the negative experience starts there. And it seems like it's not just for people who use substances, but for oftentimes almost anyone who's judged negatively on the status dimension.
Right.
But that beginning thing of you're kind of lucky to be here and you have to earn your services with good behavior is a significant challenge. The you know, the sheriffs that I worked with Tom Waddell, we're at best indifferent,
right.
Not welcoming.
Yeah.
They don't see their job as being welcoming.
Right.
They're not going to make a mistake and call somebody the wrong name, though they might misgender somebody out of an ambiguous presentation whom they haven't seen before.
Right.
Because they have had the training that says you cannot exhibit prejudice against the protected classes.
Right.
And they've internalized that information pretty well.
Right.
But in terms of the frontline staff being welcoming and saying, we're so glad you're here in spirit or in actual welcoming behavior, it's a hard thing, I think,
right.
to require and support and train to.
Right. And, you know, we have those experts like, you know, like a Barry Zevin or a Deb Warren that just exude that kind of compassionate care and, you know, can model it or do, like, detailing or something for others the way that, you know, Kelly Egan and people did the detailing for working with active users who had Hep C. I mean, you know, you can be trained up in those skills, right? And that's part of what we're asking for here. I mean, if you're funded to work with drug users, then you need to... So the onus is on you. You should be held to a standard of having culturally competent staff that are able to work with drug users. And when we look at both cascades for HIV and Hep C, you know, drug use is heavily implicated, you know. And let's put it this way. It's a very small number of providers that are super, you know, Barry Zevin standard of competence, working with people who are on the chaotic side of the spectrum, but we'll still have them viral suppressed, we'll still get them cured Hep C, and we need to champion some more providers to develop those skills. I mean, that's the population that we are targeting. That's who's getting funded. That's who we're, so, you know, people have to be trained to be able to produce.
So I think what I'm hearing, though, is part of it is, I keep going back and forth. I feel like we're all on the same page with regards to what the stressor is and what the issue is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's agreement and cohesion in the group. It's more, customer service, right? It's that kind of, and do we go macro or micro is where my mind keeps going. So do we try to spread it out really thin and do trainings and get something that's sustainable, knowing that that will probably have a little ripple effect throughout it? Or do we try to go really micro and promote a couple of devs and varies to exist? And
right. I mean, it could be like a sort of C of E thing, right? You take a couple of entities and you're like, we're going to make you the place where we want folks who have like chaotic drug use, we want to funnel it to you because you have the stars who can manage that. I mean, and every agency's had that. You know, the only ones I've worked with got like the nurse practitioner list amazing with people who are using a lot of crystal meth.
Yeah.
And you got other practitioners that are like, oh, I can't even deal with that person. Yeah. And it's sort of trying to hand it off to the person who has that skill.
Yeah.
But I feel like either that, you know, like we target a couple of clinics and make sure, try and bring them right up to COE style, or do we just try, you know, a much more broad approach?
I mean, one thing that comes up for me when you were talking is like the idea of maybe thinking about like a secret shopper, you know, a couple people who would go into these different clinics, and then we can get like sort of the baseline assessment and then go back to clinics and say like this was
right.
the review. Because I feel like a lot of people are going to be like, oh, that's not my problem, or it's hard to be objective about these things. And I know in like clinical training they use more and more standardized patients, like in order to, so that people can really get like the same kind of feedback and opportunities to sort of be assessed. And
Jose Luis and I did that with the Walgreens and the policy around accepting syringes.
Oh, interesting.
So we basically just
okay.
took sharps and went to
okay.
about 20 different Walgreens and kind of I observed and he stepped
okay.
up and
okay.
It was helpful like
yeah.
to understand what was going on and like there were rules and the ways that you were supposed to present and earn your right to be there and all that other stuff kind of came up. But it was beneficial for us both communicating to clients and communicating to Walgreens about what we experienced and what was wrong. So I think it's secret shopper is actually, I mean, in some ways, like City Clinic has a lot of secret shoppers because the community is so small, right? Something goes wrong, we hear about it. But it's quality control, and I'm not opposed to it. I mean, it's a small world. So, I mean, yeah. So.
I mean, the NTEPC thing was detailing, you know, you said you had the ones that had the expertise, they would go in and talk to our providers, and, you know, we see this, we know this, that that was successful because certainly those clinics increased the volume of active drug users for Hep C. So, I mean, this is a doable thing. It's just, you know, there's only a couple of devs in Barry, you know, that to go around. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm hoping that there's other people that just, I'm not aware of them because I haven't worked directly with them the way I work with Deb and Barry, like, all the time.
Yeah, but I'm also trying to figure out, like, how do we appeal to, like, medical directors?
Right.
And, I mean, I think Deb has her, you know, I don't know, her ways, you know, so it's sort of oftentimes sort of objective data.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to catch up the conversation with the subject line here.
They're still with the
like competence. Like
competence.
Cultural competence for providers and working with these populations from everywhere from, you know, from the whole experience, like from FRO security to front desk to, you know, other staff. Because I think it could help to identify, you know, is there a problem? What is a problem, and how do we, and then over time see is it getting better?
Right. And we've seen that with transgender, you know, experience in a medical sense. You know,
yes.
People had to be trained and retrained, and you know, it took a while for, you know, some of that to really sink in and become institutionalized. So, I mean, you know. It's not going to be like a magic wand. It's going to take a little. It's going to be a process. But you know, I think NTEPCs and trans experiences is two examples where the needle's moved sufficiently, you know, to know where it needs to be, basically.
So you can't really bottle Dr. Bourne's inimitable style.
Yes.
He's by nature extraordinarily welcoming, intuitive. And it's all because she was a social worker before she was a doctor. But to respond to your question about do we create centers of excellence versus do you try and spread the technology through the service community, the problem with creating centers of excellence is that somebody goes to one of the places that's not the center of excellence and gets blown out of the water.
You mean like so traumatized that it's never
they just
back.
Might not come back. And they might say all places are like this one. And especially, you know, we have a community of people who need hepatitis C care and HIV care in the Bayview. And they're nailed into the Bayview. And that's where they've been for most of their adult lives. You're not necessarily going to get them to come start receiving hepatitis care downtown at your center of excellence. So the question for me, I think, is how does a universal capacity for welcoming behavior. I like the idea of a secret shopper, the same person who presents with the same difficult behaviors, and you know, like
I just score.
So the person who's waiting for an initial appointment for a doctor, the second the nursing staff are ready.
I gotta go use the bathroom. Let me go use the bathroom. Okay, that's gonna be all right, right?
And then spends 15 minutes in the bathroom while everybody is really upset and comes back out and gets told, no, we can't see you today. We're going to have to reschedule you, which is what quite reasonably might happen, given how clinic volumes are. But the other thing about secret shoppers is they take staff time that is then not used for patient care.
Right.
So unless it's, I just get through registration and create an assessment off of that experience, I'd rather, you know, patient care is the scarce commodity, right?
Well,
so it's hard to balance.
Yeah, the secret shopper, I feel like, is just a detail at the moment. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't want to
get... Maybe something carried forward or other funding, like, you know, could be...
Well,
what I struggle with, I don't know all the community providers as well as I'd like them, but I really know the DPH providers, and I know the clinics, and I know the people in the front office. So I'm trying to... step back from my sense of that. And if I could design the training, not participate in the process, like, I'm not worried about necessarily transgender issues, one-on-one, even substance abuse. It's what happens when people come in surviving from the street and bring all that energy and that approach in, and the provider who, like, has, you know, the front-end provider who is struggling, it's been a long day from her, she's been screamed at 5 times, she's invariably an African-American woman with a slight variation of being, you know, and she's going back to take care of her 3 kids. And I'm not prescribing one person, I'm describing like 80% of the staff. And it's like this kind of like transgender schmansgender at this point, or, you know, substitute. It's really the behaviors where someone comes in and is bringing all this energy, and they're just not having it. They're tired. They've already seen 4 people. They didn't get their lunch. You know, and so, and then we say, oh, trauma-informed care and stuff, and you know, people's compassion at a certain point runs out. Now, I'm not saying there's not transphobia, homophobia, or racism, but it's just not my sense of how we move the needle. So I'll just put that out there for the professional to say. So really, I mean, for me, it's a lot about training and also helping more the de-escalation skills, and also supporting these folks, because it's a damn hard job.
Right. And all those positions are underpaid, and that's why you get such a turnover, because they're like, I'm paid enough to take this shit every day.
It just gets old when the person screams at you, whether the person's transgender or not, or whether the person's it's just gets old. So I'm struggling, but I do think that there's absolutely opportunity for training, but I'd almost suggest to the group of someone who's observed the DPH clinics, I can't really speak even that well for the hospital clinics, you can really speak better, or the community clinics, but I think that's where I put the money.
Yeah, I mean, in part, I mean, Jason and I were just talking about this on the way here. I mean, City Clinic, I think, is like my home clinic and just a good example of a clinic that's been struggling to figure out how to meet the needs of, you know, substance using people with more mental health issues. And the kinds of incidents that come up, I'm trying to figure out, like, what would help the staff and take it to the next level. And, you know, one of the staff people we were talking about actually was on the HOT team, right, several years ago. And, you know, she is definitely the lead. I would say, like, if there is a situation that sort of there needs to be some kind of de-escalation. So, I mean, I wonder if there's just like, if it's part of training or a program or something where someone actually goes out in the field and actually like experiences like a day with, you know, an outreach worker, you know, and just like sort of walks in other people's shoes. I don't know what anyone else thinks about that, but I don't know if sitting in a room training is going to.
I mean, we do a lot of glide uptake people, and the feedback is that it was like immensely helpful because it's the real world and it's not the classroom and role playing. You know, and it also it's modeled continuously, so they see a lot of different variations of interacting with people across the spectrum. You know, and some of those folks who are chaotic are still super appreciative, but still distracted and not to go off on tangents trying to bring it back to this over and get those hepsy nets. So let's move on to this. I think this is, you know, something that we need to come up with, you know,
But I will say, if you guys do want to try another pilot where we actually have frontline workers get to partnership and have a training or an experience doing outreach or linkage or something, I'm happy to push that internally and try a pilot.
Cool. The next one was an easier one.
Actually, Paul, did you get to that second bullet point there?
Which one, sir?
Substance use care in hospitals.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Did?
About people being discharged because they're...
Oh, I mean, that's separate from discharge. It's
right.
Sort of flowed from one to the next.
Yeah, that's correct. So, yeah, so substance use care in hospitals. Well, I mean, I forget who said that one. The one that I'm hearing with people is the thing where, you know, they go in for something and like they're getting sick. They won't prescribe them anything while they're there. And, you know, you're talking to people with like serious illness. You know. And they just pull out the drip and they just jump in bed and they go to the car park and they get high. You know,
so you mean for people who come in with significant illness and end up being in withdrawal,
not very long after
yes.
they hit the ER and
yes.
then make a decision to exit Shanks Mare and sacrifice the caravan
yes.
because they're getting sick.
And it could be like, you know, massive abscess, it's like outrageous, or, you know, heart conditions, you know, kinds of
right.
serious complications, and they're just, you know, if they're not going to treat me for my current need, which is I'm getting dope sick, I've got to deal with it. And they just sacrifice the, you know, they're triaging, they're like, I need to get well before I can even fucking deal. And that, you know, that's something that's good. You know, people who have limbs amputated and shit, I mean, it's, you know, that, and it's just ongoing, right? I mean, I don't know if you were, you know, it's an ongoing, it happens like way too frequently. I don't know if it's, you know, you can't give, you just can't prescribe when somebody self-identifies as, you know, I have an opioid use disorder, and they're like, I need to be medicated real soon, or because we're just going to, and they're like, well, we're sorry, we'll give you Valium or some shit, you know, but you're not getting anything else.
So, can I ask a process comment? Is the thought to go through these and give them detail?
I think we're still, you know, throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks right now.
Okay.
And the lines that we kind of agree as a group have a little traction, and they're, you know, they kind of fit in with the council coming up with some kind of recommendations or a suggested policy change or a training or, you know, things that have that are actionable.
So we're still in kind of a brainstorming
yeah,
space.
I think
okay.
Just because the first group was just us, so we need to get you guys.
Oh, I didn't realize
yeah,
that.
Was good.
Okay.
We had a lot of topics. But what any other points might want to care about? I suppose in your clients of.
No, I mean, I think you covered it.
And it's similar, I've had, you know, nurses who also come and play. There's usually the nurses that are really, those that help my MPs that are really talented, working with people who are users, and then there's like other ones that are just like, oh, that's yours. I'm like, you got that one. You got that one. And it's kind of weird that they never want to learn how that person is so good at that, but they just kind of hand up and defer to the expert. And never want to like shadow the expert. What does the expert do that I could learn to do so that I could be better at my fucking job?
I guess along those lines, though, there is like an NP conference that happens every year, in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could try to, I don't know, recommend a training or bring this to the attention.
Yes.
I think that, if I recall the discussion from the co-chair meeting, one of the challenges around substance use care in hospitals was around ER. So if someone's presenting as, I'm sick, and I'm sick turns out to be, I'm having a problem with my substance use, rather than, I have this thing.
Right.
Many ER doctors are like, okay, well, you're in this box here. I'm going to either put you to the side, or say I can't help you, or just move you along.
Well, there's
this
thing called ED case management now.
ED case management been around for a while.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe they had an expansion, right? I don't know. I feel like of navigators, but we've had. Yeah.
But they're not specifically tasked with response for people who present with a risk of opiate withdrawal and physical health care challenge. They're primarily tasked with engaging with folks who are repeatedly using the ED versus linking to primary care and getting the underlying medical challenge taken care of. Many of those folks turn out to be people with opiate use disorders, but also with severe mental illness who, you know, can push the button and get into the ER but can't make any gains on top of that.
So, I mean, this may be, I'm sure you guys have the answer to this, but I don't know. And I've worked with a lot of these clients. So when you do have the instance that we've been discussing, policy-wise, because I think one of the things we're talking about is the policy is to, with somebody who is potentially going into withdrawal or already in withdrawal, say they come in an ambulance and they're already starting to experience withdrawal, are they just giving gabapentin or are they giving any sort of maintenance dose of opiates as a policy?
They're not giving maintenance dose.
So, and is that a policy that we feel like is addressable, or is that just going to be a thing that...
I don't know.
emergency rooms are
right.
not going to look at. Because it seems like
there's
an issue at hand.
They get, like, in places like, I think the guy in Oakland started doing mats and then went to the serum for people, you know, so they were getting medical-assisted treatment, you know, not. So, I mean, that's progressive. You know, like, I think in Canada, they were just straight up prescribing, you know, pharmaceutical heroin, basically. You know? So, I mean, these are, you know, there's other medical establishments that deal with that completely differently. I don't know if it's, you know, drug war hysteria, you know, the people's fear of their license, if they're just seen as, you know, willy nilly. No, they create a culture where you just go to the emergency room and get a free shot, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, sure.
Right. And if, I mean, it's like, which, that's not a bad thing, though. That's not a bad thing. I mean, but then do you just make that a program like you have in the, you know, Midtown? In Toronto, there's like 375 people, and they get prescribed diacetyl heroin, you know, basically pharmaceutical heroin.
But I do think math is going to be coming soon to a theater near all of us because of our 45, at least pushing. So that will be a change.
Right.
Yeah, because I know there's all the MPI numbers, there with global provider numbers that's all getting pushed now. So
yeah.
That will change the system somewhat.
Right.
You know, the ER thing, I think that will allow us qualified to speak on the primary care clinics. My guess is part of the driver there is a move to reduce just prescribing opiates for pain medication, and there is a perception and probably some reality that clients are self-advocating by showing up at the ER to get additional, whether it's to treat their pain or to financially sustain themselves through other things. So, and then the ER providers are getting a certain kind of lean on it, like this, especially if the person's in care and they're being managed in primary care, if we're trying to taper them and have them do other things and just pop pills, you're really undermining this process if you just give them a bunch of pills to get them out of your hair.
Okay.
So this is not necessarily my opinion, but it's what I observe. You're nodding your head.
Yeah,
so,
it's very popular.
Yeah. So I don't have a good answer for it, except that I do think probably this whole thing about making it easy to get on agonists for it, different options is really
yes.
important.
So I do feel the need to share my story of when I showed up at the ER in general with a migraine. This was 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They put me on a gurney and rolled me outside. I woke up the next morning covered in dew, still outside.
Covered in what?
In dew, morning dew.
Oh, right.
Come outside the building in the air. Wow.
And I was
did it.
I was just too out of the light. Like, I didn't figure it out. I just woke up and walked away. And then years later, I was like, I thought I was drug seeking. You know? Fascinating.
Well,
so one thing that sometimes really comes down for migraine.
Sleeping is actually knocking yourself out, actually, is the best thing. But
one thing that comes up for me is if somebody goes to jail who is open with one of our methadone clinics, within 24 hours, they're supposed to have their methadone dose delivered to them in jail. I think Hunter's point takes over the job. And you can have certainly had people who go into the ER who are maintained on methadone who will be there for long enough that they should get their next methadone dose. And I think it's kind of unclear if they will. They're much more likely to if they go into SF General and they're dosing at SF General.
Right.
But even so, it's a separate computer system. The LCR does not say, the LCR is not Methasoft.
Right.
And so they have to be prepared to advocate with nursing virtually from the moment they get in, saying, please call methadone and establish what my dose is so that you can prescribe it. And if they're disorganized or confused or in pain, they may not successfully self-advocate. And the doctors in the ER are going to treat the presenting medical complaint, that big abscess you're talking about, first. Later, somebody's going to come to them and say, so are you taking methadone? They say, yes. Where? Well, right next door. So maybe a advocacy start point is that people who come to hospital who are maintained on agonist therapy should have a sort of built-in access to that treatment at the same schedule they would normally have it as a matter of the fifth vital sign.
Right.
It's avoids the question that you're talking about around the legitimacy of C2 prescriptions and the push to not maintain people on C2s and not undermine the primary care. This is a medication the person is already prescribed. And would we have a lower standard in hospital than we would in jail? I mean, their target is within 24 hours, your existing methadone dose gets delivered to you. And I don't see why that might not be a good point of advocacy for folks. Or within 24 hours, your methadone dose gets delivered to you and you have access to a MAT consultation.
Yeah, I mean, I had a patient actually who went in recently and had a major problem with getting, for like a leg abscess, and had a major problem getting like, they're on oxycodone and methadone. But for days and days. And yeah, so I agree that this is like a big problem, but I'm also wondering, is it, what, you know.
Beyond the scope of
what. Yeah, can we, or do we have the right people here to know exactly where that discussion already lives, and I would think that like the inpatient addiction team would be a resource to begin to like talk more about it. But what would we do, sort of extrinsic to the system?
You guys have been in touch like with Judy Martin, like she's kind of the guru over the method on Dr. Martin. Is this stuff that's risen to her? I just can't imagine she wouldn't have a place to try and make that happen.
That meeting with HIV with Chep, well, she was not there, and the following meeting Edwin was there, and that's like useless. So in terms of getting anywhere with any conversation except what the policy is, so I think the next meeting
she may be there.
I'm hoping that she will be, because now Caboose is no longer there, and Caboose I think was interested in the conversation and was also interested in like how might we be able to partner to kind of look at some of the intersections? Because one of the things they said at that first meeting was the week prior to the meeting, they had like 8 beds open in drug treatment that weren't filled. And a lot of the people around the table were people that are working in the intersection of being funded through HIV, through CHIP, right? Or through Brian White or wherever. And a lot of folks around the table also have some money through CBHS. And the thresholds for access into drug treatment are just too high. And there's no mechanism for funding low threshold services through Medi-Cal. And I think this is the other policy issue that we're starting to talk to the city policy department with, is about we need champions to champion the policy issues on the state level and on the federal level potentially to kind of make some opportunities available. But in the meantime, especially given that there's, with the Medi-Cal expansion and with the parity around substance use and mental health, and now with the waiver, there's more money in the system for substance use. But what's happening is now, because you're getting more Medi-Cal, they're not replacing the general fund. They're like, oh, you only have so much money in the system. If we get it through Medi-Cal, we get it through Medi-Cal, that's it. But there's no more money. So, like, for example, if someone has 2 treatment episodes inpatient, that's all they get in a year. But if they really need another treatment episode, they just can't get it because Medi-Cal will pay for it. Well, in the old world order, the city would just pay for it,
right.
Or be general fund, right? But now it's like, well, too bad, we don't have general fund for that. It's supposed to be Medi-Cal, and that's it. So there's significant problems in these areas, you know. Significant. But I think having CPHS at the table, just even start having these conversations. I think what CPHS needs to hear and understand is the other sections and other funding is really paying a lot of times for this low threshold service, right? And how could we partner together to make sure to capitalize on what opportunities are and are not currently in CPHS?
Well, in truth, we're not using right away dollars for substance use treatment.
Right, it used to, but that used to happen. Yeah.
Then we backfilled it back in the day with general fund. I think very few people here remember that. But yes, your point is still well taken. And so maybe we can talk offline when that meeting next happens. I'll try and come.
Yeah, who was?
Hannah.
Hannah.
Okay.
Yeah, put it together. I don't think, like I said, I don't think the second meeting was as successful. I think what they were doing was bringing drug treatment centers in to talk about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just more
We a lot of people in the room were familiar with what was being done,
right.
But we're having more problems with what the barriers are and the challenges are, and how could we get someplace around those challenges?
Yeah. And there's like a leadership void.
Yeah,
I know
there is, right.
So
I guess I don't know if Judith could come, or you know, well this new position also that Grant is. And that, so when he came to the planning council, he said that person will be also looking at the intersections of substance use.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a mental health position?
Yeah. Who is that person?
Dr. Anton Glenn. Former director of PES.
Mm. So understands the issues, huh?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I don't know how much experience he's had at the outpatient side.
Yeah.
He's been running PES.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I agree that how much impact we could have on that, but I still feel that maybe there's some kind of recommendation, you know, bring that up to people's attention, however.
And just in terms of our process, it was kind of a narrowly focused thing, which I was asking about, like, methadone for people while they're inpatient. Like, that's an actionable thing, and
right.
Like, you know, whereas reforming, that's not that they're not actionable, that's a lot bigger scope.
Yeah.
So I think similar to Dr. Michael, how do we scope this? So I think that's probably the next step to the comment. You might choose two or three to work on now,
right.
And not try and do all of it. Because the one you mentioned, there's a big one.
Yeah.
But rather than reforming Medi-Cal policy, there could be advocacy to have BHS tag general fund dollars and leave them tagged for low threshold services that aren't eligible for Medi-Cal reimbursement.
Right. I think even if we were able to get a change in the Medi-Cal, I don't know how helpful that would be, because you also have to also waive Title 22 completely, and I don't know how easy that would be.
Right.
So, because they want to put some kind of restrictions on it, you know, or some kind of, you know, audit chain on some level, and then it becomes too restrictive to make it actually feasible. But that was my question to Edwin, and Edwin was like, well, the money that's in the system is the money that's in the system. There's no more money. I'm like, well, that's kind of non-responsive, because what I'm asking you about is what happened to the general dollars if we're funding all of these services before.
Right.
And, you know, he doesn't really have anything to add other than that statement. So that's why it's, you know, for me, it's just generally useful to have someone else in the room who could actually have a conversation about it and not just give you a political, you know, response. And even if it's a, you know, we can't do anything with the general fund, or here's the people you should talk to about general fund. I don't have any control over general fund. Here's what you would need to do. Those kind of answers. I think those are the kind of answers we need.
Right.
Okay.
Because it costs the city money anyway. You go send the person to PES, then that's more money than possibly than sending them to another drug treatment episode. Or instead of putting them in a bed where, because if they have out-of-county Medi-Cal now, because the state made a decision that, as all of you know, right? So you have to have in-county Medi-Cal to get in-county services. So if you have, and that's not how people that are, you know, navigating homelessness and marshes, that they're kind of floating around everywhere. And the county that they have, where they have Medi-Cal, doesn't necessarily want to release their Medi-Cal because they're still getting services there.
Right.
So they
can't. Well, they're getting right. And if their services are serving them so much, the better. For the bottom line of the dollar.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Again, not a problem we can solve immediately, but I think longer term, these issues.
Kind of identify.
And what we're doing here at ACE Foundation, we've been talking about kind of a possible expansion of our policy department to kind of focus on these very intersections. Because when you think about, you know, it's within the purview of the ACE Foundation too, because where this leads around for people that have HIV or at risk for HIV is really large. So these are barriers to kind of getting people through, maybe into a higher threshold when they're ready for some kind of service, and making some improvements at the pace that they can.
So we came back to Earth with a much more practical solution, a suggestion in the next bullet, which was about expanding access to lockers. We're looking at viral suppression and Hep C cure, you know. So one of the main obstacles for homeless folks is
losing medications and the whole rigmarole of trying to, you know, especially the price of Hep C meds. If you lost your meds and trying to go back and get re-upped, there's a problem. I mean, like, some clinics had a little secret stashes to help with that. I won't name names in case they're not allowed to, but that's the kind of shit that you need right there.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is frequent again, and with the, you know, one of the things that really
precipitated this along with Dave's increase in the harassment around homeless folks and our patients, you know, we know being disrupted and losing meds at DPW. Jason, I know you've seen many.
It's quite brutal
when they decide you need to leave right now, and people are a little discombobulated and they don't know how to gather their stuff, and then they start throwing it in the van, and that's, you know, $10,000 worth of fucking Hep C meds just went in the van, and they're not getting them. And then when they get their head together and settle down and they go back and look through what they were able to take, they realize the meds are missing. And, you know, when you go and present at the clinic, you're like, hey, I need you know, my Harvoni or whatever you're on, you know. They're like, okay, blah, blah, blah. And some people not, you know, they're not going to get meds. And some people will, but it's a big rigmarole. And we've had clients, you know, like, who have been moved like 5 times in one day, you know, from wherever they've tried to sell. Like, not uncommon to be that harassed.
So, you know, the notion of lockers
and the access to those lockers, you know, I know that Sixth Street's piloted it, and I don't know if you want to share the
successes and challenges.
Well, I think it's going fine. I mean, you talked to Darpin about last time about getting to zero, was talking about this, or some other group, and the challenge that they had was, you know, you don't have 24-hour access. Well, people don't have 24-hour access at our site either. And it's working effectively enough, and I think you just wrap some other things around it. You know, there might be a meal or some snacks or some other type of support. And for us, all of our health educators are trained for any hours that we're open to be able to have someone access their meds. And again, we don't distribute medications. We just provide a locker where someone keeps their medications, and they get it themselves.
Yeah.
And the literature is showing, like, people paid for FCS syringe access to programs with lockers. There was some study that I read that was like super high, 97% or something. But got through to SVR 12. So
yeah, we're looking at expanding what we have available right now. We also do some limited antibiotics and some other limited medications for people as well. You know, anything that doesn't need to be refrigerated is potential.
And then things like navigation centers seem like a no-brainer, right? You got people in there for 90 days and stuff, like that could be their whole, you know, treatment for HIV, for Hep C. So
yeah, I think navigation centers are just woefully understaffed.
Yeah.
Shelters.
Right.
That's three times the staffing level of the shelter.
Right.
Yeah.
So just, if you guys think